Laudator Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Coming up in a few moments, our weekly rendezvous with our Vatican expert, Joan Lewis. But first, Jill Bevilacqua's There's More in the Sunday Gospel Than Meets the Eye.
The angel Gabriel was sent from God to a town of Galilee named Nazareth, to a virgin betrothed to a man named Joseph of the house of David. The virgin's name was Mary. Upon arriving, the angel said to her, "Rejoice, O highly favored daughter, the Lord is with you. Blessed are you among women." She was deeply troubled by his words and wondered what his greeting meant. The angel went on to say to her, "Do not fear, Mary. You have found favor with God. You shall conceive and bear a son, and give him the name Jesus. Great will be his dignity, and he will be called Son of the Most High. The Lord God will give him the throne of David his father. He will rule over the house of Jacob forever, and his reign will be without end." Mary said to the angel, "How can this be, since I do not know man?" The angel answered her, "The Holy Spirit will come upon you, and the power of the Most High will overshadow you. Hence the holy offspring will be born and will be called Son of God. Know that Elizabeth, your kinswoman, has conceived a son in her old age. She who was thought to be sterile is now in her sixth month, for nothing is impossible with God." Mary said, "I am the maidservant of the Lord. Let it be done to me as you say." With that, the angel left her.
It's hard to think of another gospel episode which has been more frequently or more lovingly represented by poets and painters than the Annunciation. But then we're talking of the Annunciation, of the most important event the world has ever known. Hardly to be called merely an episode either. The word seems to diminish the event. This unique happening, and the modern word is by far more apt, was not an isolated incident. It happened in our dimension, in time. And it had been foretold by Isaiah, "Behold, a virgin shall conceive and bear a son, and his name shall be called Emmanuel." The Annunciation, then, is part of a story, the story of salvation. But it's so momentous that it is also a story in itself. And of the four evangelists, it's Luke, that master among storytellers, who tells it. Like all good stories, it has a beginning, a middle, and an end. It's neither too long nor too short. Every word has been weighed carefully. There is not one too many. And how else could it be? For there were no witnesses of the Annunciation. Luke, then, could not have written his account, which, though a story, is not fiction, unless he had heard it from the chief protagonist, Mary herself. And she would not have been one for small talk. She would have wasted no words. The event which shaped her life must have been carved in her memory down to the tiniest detail. But she, in Luke's words, gives only the essentials. It's been left to the centuries to fill in the rest. Here's how one poet, the German Rainer Maria Rilke, imagines the encounter of Gabriel and Mary in two separate poems. Here he has given the angel these words.
"You are not nearer God than we. He's far from everyone. And yet your hands most wonderfully reveal his benison. From woman's sleeves none ever grew so ripe, so shimmeringly. I am the day, I am the dew. You, lady, are the tree. Pardon, now my long journey is done. I had forgot to say what he who sat as in the sun, grand in his gold array, told me to tell you, pensive one. Space has bewildered me. I am the start of what's begun. You, lady, are the tree. I spread my wings out wide and rose. The space around grew less. Your little house quite overflows with my abundant dress. But still you keep your solitude and hardly notice me. I'm but a breeze within the wood. You, lady, are the tree.
Scholars and theologians may balk at the opening lines and at the idea that Gabriel might be so bewildered as to forget his message, but they must allow some poetic license. In the second poem, the writer begins by giving us Mary's point of view, and then, well, let's listen.
The angel's entrance, you must realize, was not what made her frightened. The surprise he gave her by his coming was no more than sun or moonbeam shining on the floor would give another. She had long since grown used to the form that angels wear, descending, never imagining this coming down was hard for them. Oh, it's past comprehending how pure she was. Did not one day a hind that rested in a wood, watchfully staring, feel her deep influence? And did it not conceive the unicorn then without pairing, the pure beast which light begot? No, not to see him enter, but to find the youthful angel's countenance inclined so near to her that when he looked and she looked up at him, their looks so merged in one, the world outside grew vacant suddenly, and all things being seen, endured, and done were crowded into them, just she and he, eye and its pasture, vision and its view, here, at this point, and at this point alone. See, this arouses fear. Such fear both knew. Then he sang out and made his tidings known.
Let's look a moment now at the place where this historic meeting is believed to have happened. Here's what we read in the guidebook.
On the northern outskirts of downtown Nazareth is a fountain, still used by the inhabitants of the town. Tradition tells that by the fountain, the angel Gabriel first appeared to Mary while she was drawing water. From here, Mary went to her home, where the Annunciation took place.
It all sounds so matter-of-fact, doesn't it? But it was the apocryphal Gospels that started the tradition of this belief. And when the Crusaders came, they built a church to Gabriel on the spot. The guidebook goes on. Over it stands the present-day Greek Orthodox Church, built in 1769. Remnants of the Crusader Church can be seen in the crypt. The water of the Fountain of Mary, inside the crypt, is in fact conveyed into the church from a nearby spring further uphill. From here, the water is piped to a fountain. Another guidebook has a colour photograph of the crypt with the fountain and confirms that it is the only one existing in the old town of Nazareth. Traveller H.V. Morton wrote in the 30s.
One is shown all kinds of holy places in Nazareth, but perhaps the only one that rarely convinces is the Virgin's Fountain. This is, and ever has been, the only water supply of Nazareth. The stream gushes out of the mountain and runs through a conduit to a public fountain where women fill petrol tins with water all day long. The Greeks have built a church above the source of this spring, and when you go down into the darkness of the sanctuary, you can hear the water bubbling up from the rock. This must be the spring from which the Virgin Mary drew water.
Significantly, our traveller does not touch on the subject of where Gabriel came to Mary. But the traveller of today will not be able to miss the Basilica of the Annunciation. Our guidebook proclaims, "The church, located in the centre of Nazareth, is a modern structure built between 1955 and 1969 over the ruins of Byzantine and Crusader churches. It is easily recognised by its high dome, which makes it the most prominent structure in the city." Gabriel wouldn't have been able to miss it either, no doubt. But according to legend, Mary's house is no longer in Nazareth. For in the year 1291, it was carried by angels to Dalmatia, and 3 years later to Loreto on the Adriatic coast. And on April the 12th, 1916, the Congregation of Rites issued a decree stating that this house was the home of the Blessed Virgin, consecrated by the Divine Mysteries. Today, it's one of the most celebrated of Marian shrines. The house itself, though enclosed in a church, is tiny, 12 metres by 6, and on the altar is a black figure of the Virgin and Child in cedar, said to be the first work of St. Luke. When I visited Loreto years ago, the place was thronged. We were hustled round the altar and out of the church at top speed. This is my abiding memory of Mary's house. But let's return to the Gospel and its content. The first word Gabriel spoke to Mary has usually been rendered as Hail, which is the first word of the Hail Mary, also known as the Angelic Salutation. And in a homily attributed to Gregory of Nyssa, 4th century Doctor of the Church, the translation I have read is like this.
The angel comes to Mary, and entering says, Hail, full of grace. In an instant he exalts the maiden and treats her as a woman, for she has become the mother of the Lord.
But further on we find these words.
For calamity is at an end, corruption is dissolved, all sadness now has ceased, joy has flourished, the glad tidings of the prophets have come to pass.
And here seems to be the point, joy. The angel's greeting to Mary was expressed in a word normally used in Greek at the time, later translated to the Latin Ave. Luke, of course, was writing in Greek. But the Greek word meant joy, or as today's Gospel version has it, rejoice. And this seems to be the theme in these lines from the Sibylline Oracles, no connection with Virgil's Sibyl, but 14 books of didactic poetry in Greek hexameters, dating from the 2nd century.
Thus spoke the archangel to the maiden, Receive, O Virgin, the Lord in your immaculate womb. At these words the Lord gave grace to her, who was to be forever virgin. She, hearing these words, was filled with wonder and with dread. In stillness she stood trembling, bewildered, as one lost, the while her heart did throb to hear the wondrous news. Then jumped her heart with joy to find comfort in those words. She smiled with blushing cheek, delighting in her joy, heart filled with gentle modesty. And courage came again and soared the word within her womb.
Immediately after his first word, Gabriel says, O highly favoured daughter. The Jerusalem Bible reads, Rejoice, so highly favoured, while the Revised Standard Version and another older translation have Hail, full of grace. Scholars have interpreted the Greek word charis differently. Since St. Paul, we read, the word has meant sanctifying grace, but it might, according to one, have meant privilege. A present-day scholar writes, full of grace, literally filled with grace, by God himself, so as to be the mother of his son. St. Augustine puts it charmingly.
Who are you that with such faith have conceived, and soon is to become a mother? The one who created you will be born in you. Whence came to you such great goodness? You are virgin, you are holy. Much it is you have merited, or better, much it is you have received. It seems an indiscretion that I question thus the Virgin, and so disturb her reserve. But the Virgin, blushing yet, to me replies, You ask whence came to me such goodness? Listen to the angel's greeting, and believe in the salvation which comes from my womb. Believe in him in whom I have believed.
In the innumerable paintings of the scene of the Annunciation, there's almost always a lily, shown either between Mary and the angel, or in Gabriel's hand. But in a poem for Lady Day, March the 25th, an English writer exclaims, Where did Gabriel get a lily in the month of March? For in England, the Madonna lily blooms in summer. And gardener Vita Sackville-West adds, "Wherever that bright archangel found his lily, it was certainly not in the more ambitious sort of garden. It prefers the humbler home. There's an old tradition that the Madonna lily throve best in cottage gardens because the housewife was in the habit of chucking out her pail of soap suds all over the flower beds." The ceiling of the Church of the Annunciation, we read, has been fashioned in the shape of a lily. Whether Gabriel actually appeared visibly to Mary, Luke doesn't say, only he came to her, or being come in, he went in, and upon arriving. In the book of Daniel, he's described like this: "His body was clear as topaz, his face shone like lightning, his eyes were like burning lamps, his arms and legs had the gleam of bronze, and when he spoke, it was like the voice of a multitude." Writing in 1912, Rupert Brooke ended his poem, Mary and Gabriel, this way.
"The great wings were spread, showering glory on the fields and fire. The whole air singing bore him up and higher, unswerving, unreluctant. Soon he shone, a gold speck in the gold skies, then was gone. The air was colder and grey. She stood alone."
Modern poet Elizabeth Jennings has imagined the aftermath of the Annunciation.
"Nothing will ease the pain to come, though now she sits in ecstasy and lets it have its way with her. The angel's shadow in the room is lightly lifted, as if he had never terrified her there. The furniture again returns to its old simple state. She can take comfort from the things she knows, though in her heart new loving burns, something she never gave to man or God before, and this God grows most like a man. She wonders how to pray at all, what thanks to give, and whom to give them to. Alone to all men's eyes I now must go, she thinks, and by myself must live with a strange child that is my own. So from her ecstasy she moves and turns to human things at last, announcing angels set aside. It is a human child she loves, though a god stirs beneath her breast and great salvations grip her side."
Of Mary, many have been the titles and poetic descriptions. Some less well-known ones appear in this hymn by an early 5th century writer, Ezekias of Jerusalem.
"Who calls her Mother of Light, Star of Life? Some call her Throne of God, others Great Temple of Heaven. One, a seat not inferior to that of the Cherubim, yet another, Virgin and Fertile Garden, Vine of fine grapes, flourished and untouched, pure turtle dove, chaste dove, uncorrupted cloud filled with rain, jewel case, whose gem shines more brightly than the sun, quarry from which has been hewn without cutting the stone which shelters all the earth, vessel without steersman, charge of precious things, treasure which grows rich. Yet others call her lamp without a wick, which burns by itself, ark more spacious, longer, more noble than that of Noah."
St. Paulinus of Nola adds yet another image, but provides us also with the only possible ending to these reflections on the Annunciation.
"God created the holy maidservant like the interior courtyard of a temple, respectfully surrounded by reverence, open to the rain and the dew. Then he himself descended from the clouds of heaven on silent wing, soft and humble, as once the dew fell upon Gideon's fleece. But no one has succeeded in penetrating the mystery, fulfilled in the silent way of God, become man in the womb of a virgin."
And our thanks there go to Jill Bevilacqua. She'll be back again at the same time next week. Meanwhile, time to join our Vatican expert, EWTN's Bureau Chief here in Rome, Joan Lewis. So, Joan, welcome back to the show.
Well, here we are in the month of December as the city and the Vatican and St. Peter's Square are getting beautiful for the holidays. St. Peter's Square is coming along. That nativity scene will be unveiled, of course, on the 24th of December. There's going to be a choir, all kinds of extra added attractions this year. It's going to have a Marian theme because of the nativity scene being put up in the year in which John Paul was beatified and his great love for Mary. So they are giving it a Marian theme. So everybody's getting ready for all the holidays. The Holy Father's activities continue, though, obviously. Sunday, as he often does or has been doing in Advent, he visited a Roman parish, Santa Maria delle Grazie at Casal Bocconi. And there's many, many churches in Rome. If you look at an index of church names called Santa Maria delle Grazie, there's one right over here on Via Fornaci, and Our Lady of Graces. Anyway, so the Pope did visit this parish. We have two Sundays in a row where he's out of the Vatican, obviously this Sunday at the Rabibbia prison.
In the footsteps of John 23rd, who was the first Pope to do this wonderful gesture
exactly.
In 1958. Christmas 1958.
Oh, it was Christmas 58. I hadn't kept track of the year. So these are all gestures that are very much appreciated, obviously the visit to the parish and then the Holy Father, of course, returned to St. Peter's Square for the traditional Angelus on Sunday. And this is always a wonderful Sunday, Laetare Sunday. Rejoice. The liturgy of that very day invites us to happiness, to await not sadly, but joyfully. And he said, this time of Advent, let us reinforce our certainty that the Lord came among us and he continually renews his presence of consolation, love, and joy. And it is a very beautiful period in the Church of Anticipation. Now, on Gaudete or Laetare Sunday, the Pope does something very wonderful every year, the third Sunday of Advent. He blesses statues of the baby Jesus that children bring to St. Peter's Square. It's always a very touching moment. I mean, some of the statues are so small, they're teensy little statues of baby Jesus that can fit in the palm of a child's hand. Others are a little bit bigger. They are blessed, and they will go into nativity scenes in homes and schools and parishes and so forth on Christmas Eve. And thought it was really cute, the Pope greeted the children, and he asked them, when they pray before their nativity scenes in their home, to remember the Pope in prayer just as he remembers them. So always a lovely Sunday, and it's just wonderful. I live so close to St. Peter's Square, of course, and can often go there on a Sunday, even at the tail end of an Angelus, but the enormous crowds that come, that have come since day one of Benedict's pontificate to hear him pray and then reflect on many, many different themes. And he continued to meet up until last weekend the bishops of the United States who are in Rome on ad limina. And what was really, how good is the Lord? The bishops of Region 3, which includes the states of Pennsylvania and New Jersey, they had just completed, they've been in Rome for like almost 2 weeks. They got on a plane Sunday to leave after their ad limina, the very day, hours after Cardinal John Foley died in Philadelphia. And of course, all of our listeners have heard him on television, on the radio. He had that magnificent voice and did the Christmas liturgies for, oh my gosh, 25, 26 years, I think.
And he was a good friend of ours here at the radio.
And, well, you know, and the fact that he died Sunday, I know a lot of the bishops, because they told me they were very worried that he would die during the ad limina, because the ad limina is not something you can just say, oh, hey, we'll be back next week and finish it. It's planned for a long time in advance. The funeral Friday, what for me, I've known him for many, many years. He's been to my home for dinner many times. So the cardinal died Sunday morning early in Darby, Pennsylvania, which is not very far from Philadelphia. And I have to tell you, I really got the chills, a bittersweet moment. On Tuesday, I went to open my mail, a whole big slew of Christmas cards, and there was the card from Cardinal Foley. So anyway, the Pope did send a telegram, of course, on Monday to Archbishop Chaput of Philadelphia for the cardinal's death, and he mentioned that he was the Grand Master Emeritus of the Equestrian Order of the Holy Sepulchre, and also he had been the president for, I think it was about 24 years, of the Pontifical Council for Social Communications. I particularly enjoyed the Holy Father's words. He said, "I also pray that Cardinal Foley's lifelong commitment to the Church's presence in the media will inspire others to take up this apostolate so essential to the proclamation of the gospel and the progress of the new evangelization." Another event on Monday, looking back at the Pope's week, it seems the bigger activities fit into the earlier days of the week. There was a Mass in late afternoon, of course, in St. Peter's Basilica for the Feast of Our Lady of Guadalupe, who's the patron of Latin America. And during that Mass, I'm sure our listeners know by now, but Pope Benedict announced that he would make an apostolic trip to Mexico and Cuba before Easter 2012. So I've forgotten the exact date of Easter, but I believe what we're looking at March for this trip. And the Mass on Monday night also celebrated the 200th anniversary of the independence of countries of Latin America and the Caribbean, and the Pope's homily focused on that anniversary. But he said, in addition to celebrating, to recalling the historical, social, and political aspects of those events in Latin America, he said, people should renew their gratitude to the Almighty for the great gift of faith that they received in those countries, a faith that announces the redeeming mystery of the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ. So, beautiful Mass and filled to the rafters with curial workers and people in Rome, whom, and ambassadors and so forth.
That takes us to Wednesday, because Tuesday's a day of rest.
Exactly, when the Pope's preparing for Wednesday for the catechesis at the general audience. And, of course, in this show, we only do have time for the highlights. I'm sure that those who listen to us regularly know that we don't cover every papal event. We'd need an hour-long show. But the Wednesday general audience, the Pope has been dedicating catechesis to prayer, and he's particularly focusing on Jesus' prayer in his life. And this week he focused on Jesus' prayer in the context of his healing miracles. And the Pope kind of dedicated it to the healing of the deaf man and the raising of the dead from Lazarus. And the Pope said, "Jesus' prayer on these occasions reveals not only his profound identification with suffering, but also his unique relationship with the Father." So very, very wonderful words. And I hope people know they can go online to, the for example, the Vatican Press Office, to the Holy Father, his weekly catechesis. And there are shorter versions in different languages of the Pope's longer catechesis in Italian. So if you don't understand that, but you do want to read several paragraphs in English, if you're French, French, Polish, it's in a number of different languages. So people can go to the website and read what the Holy Father says. It's meant for them. It's meant for us.
Thank you very much, Joan.
See you next week. Happy won't, I guess. Yes, right.
Happy Christmas. Then.
Merry Christmas and Happy New Year, and see you in the new year.
Well, you were listening there, as always, at this time of week, to Joan Lewis, our Vatican expert and EWTN's bureau chief here in Rome. That brings me up to time. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Thanks so much for listening. Be sure to join us again at this same time tomorrow. Meanwhile, if you wish to check out our website, the address is www.vaticanradio.org. Bye for now. You've been listening to the English programme of Vatican Radio. Laudetur Jesus Christus.